You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNADS.com.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of the Agile Uprising podcast. I'm your host, Troy Lightfoot. And with me, I have a very special guest. His name is Bart Kay. Say hello, Bart.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. And so Bart and I are going to be talking about empiricism. So, and the title of this podcast is Empiricism, the Missing Piece in Agile, which alone seems silly to me because Agile is meant to be based off of empirical process, but we're going to be getting into why I think it seems to be missing, and I would imagine a lot of our listeners might agree. So, Bart. Bart is a scientist and a former lecturer, and he has a lot of experience with the empirical method. And when it comes to actually creating peer-reviewed papers and reviewing some scientific papers himself. So, Bart, why don't you just give a brief introduction to yourself and your background in empiricism, and we'll go from there.
My background is in exercise physiology first and foremost. I have three advanced degrees. I have a reasonable sort of publication list of peer reviewed publications, experimental works in the area of exercise performance, human nutrition, physiology, anatomy. I've even published a few commentaries on statistical procedure and methodology itself from a pure mathematical standpoint, I guess. And I have a sort of history of teaching exercise physiology, anatomy and physiology, nutrition, research methods, statistics, etc. So that's kind of where I'm coming from. I've written a couple of book chapters about nutrition and things, which you can find floating around the place. So that's really me in a nutshell. I've been involved in the science. I've been involved in producing the science in the first instance. And also, I've been involved as a peer reviewer. I've sat on the boards of several journals peer reviewing others' work, basically to decide, you know, is this up to scratch for publication or not. So you can say I've sat on both sides of that. So that's me. But in terms of software development, not a clue.
Well, that's okay. So one of the main reasons I wanted to have you on is because, well, I am a patron of yours. And just for those who don't know, Bart is a bit of an entertainer on YouTube, I would say, as well as a lecturer. So he kind of has both things going. But on his Patreon, it's basically just mainly science-based lectures. So while the entertainment stuff is fun, I really enjoy the in-depth science behind Bart's Patreon videos. And so I've been watching them, you know, for most of the year. And I kind of looked up, Bart, a lot of your publications on Google Scholar that you've published. And I think you and Pim, who's your girlfriend, you actually somewhat recently published a paper together. Is that correct?
That's right, we did, yeah. We did a study where we looked at commercially available omega-3 oil supplements that people buy and take and go, oh, this is good for this and that and the other thing. And we looked into it to see, you know, is there anything in here that could, that could be a problem? And came back with the answer, yes, absolutely. Most, okay. There were 12 samples that we tested. And these were just supplements that we bought across the counter at pharmacies in the UK where we lived at the time. And we bought according to the pharmacist saying, this is the one you should buy. So we did, and we took them back to the lab, and we analyzed them, and we found levels of very, very dangerous oxidation products called aldehydes in the omega-3 oils in 8 out of 12 cases.
Wow. Okay. Awesome. Yeah. So I did read that paper. I won't say I read every word of that paper because there's a lot to it, but but I did read it and I got the general gist of it. And so that's a recent paper. So, yeah. So let's talk about, before we get into the Agile side of things, let's talk about just what is empiricism in general. And then I'll talk about what it's meant to be in the Agile side of things. So Bart, in your experience and knowledge, how would you define empiricism in an empirical process?
I guess in terms of the scientific method, in terms of what my exposure to it, what I've been using it for in my career to date, is that it's a disciplined approach to the testing of hypotheses. Mm-hmm. So if I have a theory, for example, omega-3 supplements are good or not, or more to the point, a hypothesis is more a very structured statement around what we will observe as a relationship between two given variables, or indeed categoricals. They don't have to be variables.
Okay.
So we could say, okay, my hypothesis is omega-3 supplements, a large number of them anyway, contain dangerous oxidation products. The empirical method is to go and test that hypothesis. So what I need is a valid, or internally and externally valid mechanism to empirically test that hypothesis. So I need a machine that's capable of measuring whether or not these things are in that oil,
mm-hmm.
used in that paper that you were talking about. We used a machine called a 1H nuclear magnetic resonance spectroscopy machine. So that's a lot of big words, but what it basically means is it's a machine that you put the oil sample in and it puts it in a very, very strong electromagnetic field, which lines all the molecules up so that we can scan them. And then we fire a beam of photons from another direction through the sample. The sample absorbs and then re-emits those photons in discrete energy packages depending on what's in the sample, and then we read that spectra and we do a fast Fourier transform on it. Actually, those are interested in what we did, and it tells us, hey, that's what's in the sample, and that was the way that we tested and said, well, look, yes there they are, there's the aldehydes, that's the thing we thought might be in there, they are, whoops, that's a problem if you sell omega-3 supplements to people and tell them that they're good for them.
Okay.
In a nutshell, that's the empirical process. It's the setting up of a hypothesis that is empirically testable with numbers, or indeed with a categorical yes or no, depending on what the question is. And it's having a methodology that's capable of refuting the hypothesis, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And then the responsibility of the scientist actually is to prove him or herself wrong, if they possibly can.
Right.
So our goal, Pim and myself, our goal was to set up a hypothesis that there are dangerous oxidation products in omega-3 oils and then prove ourselves wrong.
That's the key point.
We were unable to prove ourselves wrong.
Right.
Well, the hypothesis has to be accepted. In 8 out of 12 cases, we found dangerous oxidation products, no question.
What I want to say is that it's not only the testing or debunking of a hypothesis or not debunking it, and it's not only a peer review, it's actually a replication that's meant to happen as part of this empirical process. So there's multiple steps that are part of the scientific method. So that's kind of the lead up into getting into the Agile space. So we have this concept of hypothesis-driven development in software, which is, you come up with a hypothesis and you go and test out that hypothesis. You build something called an MVP, which stands for minimum viable product. And when they say viable, they're not talking about actually usable. They're talking about testing the viability of your hypothesis. That's what that means. Like, it's basically the smallest thing to go build to go test this hypothesis. And we call that the lean startup method. It's a process. So a lot of startups over the past decade or so have really embraced this method. And a lot of larger companies are trying to implement this way of working, as opposed to the traditional way, which is someone goes and makes a presentation, they get funding to go build something, they go build it for a year or two. It's supposed to be a year, it ends up being 2 years. They put it out in the market, and then either nobody uses it, or one of their competitors has beat them to the punch, or, you know, there's a lot of, let's say, negative consequences of building software this way, not using an empirical approach. So the folks who created this Agile manifesto, and particularly the processes in Agile, have this empirical mindset, the scientific mindset, and they design these processes in a way to be able to use an empirical process to give the teams that are working on the software and the companies this advantage over other companies. For example, if you have one company who uses this process and is constantly trying to test out their hypothesis, multiple hypothesis, they're able to put things in production more quickly, get things in the hands of end users to go test those hypotheses, to pivot quickly or not pivot or keep going. Versus a company who doesn't use a process like that, who does everything with assumptions, assuming they know what everybody wants. And we know how that likely ends up, right? Because I don't care who you are, it's impossible to know what everybody wants all the time, right? It's just guesses. So, and human beings are usually pretty bad at those guesses. So the faster we can test our hypothesis, the faster it's better. So we have a few processes. So we have this one thing called hypothesis-driven development in this lean startup method, meaning any size idea, but generally we use them in we have something called scaling, which is basically taking multiple teams and scaling it up to our organization. We use this concept at a large initiative level. So if you have a large initiative that might take 9-12 months to build, right? What can we build in 2 to 4 weeks that can go test this hypothesis? And what kind of leading indicators and metrics can we use to prove? The idea is to disprove a hypothesis. We want to set the metrics up in a way which we can say, hey, we want to find out what we're wrong about before we waste 8 months worth of money and time, right? That's the concept. So a lot of companies who are really, really good at this that you might have heard of, for example, like Facebook is a big one, Google. So there's something like, I read 27 different versions of Facebook right now, and nobody knows that they're using different versions around the world. It's because they are constantly testing out their hypothesis. They're testing out using actual data. They're testing out with metrics, and they see how users interact with the system in production, not like in a lab somewhere, right? So that's an example of a company who can rapidly do it. So that being said, I want to talk about something called Scrum, and I'm actually glad that I have you on the call, because, correct me if I'm wrong, but you have been a consultant to the New Zealand All Blacks, correct?
I was involved in the preparation for the 2011 World Cup campaign, which was a successful campaign. New Zealand won the World Cup that year. It was held in New Zealand and Australia, so it was kind of home team advantage as well as all of that. My specific role was in analyzing the exact movement patterns and thus the exact physiological demands of the All Blacks undertaken in 4 test matches leading up to the World Cup campaign. So in other words, what I had to do was sit there with footage, specialized footage taken from a fixed camera mounted on the grandstand, and each camera was assigned a role of following a given player on the All Blacks team.
Yeah. Now,
there were 15 players on the field at any given time. So there were 15 cameras. Each had a player's jumper number, or their substitute, as the case may be.
Mm-hmm.
And that camera followed that player throughout the entire 90 minutes of the game. Well, 80 minutes plus 10 in the middle. But anyway, that's...
Okay.
So what I had to do was quantify the exact, you know, he was stood still, he was walking, he was jogging, he was tackling someone, he was being tackled, he was, you know... Not only that, but also where he was on the paddock, the direction that he was running, the pace at which he was running, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, so that we had an exact template.
Mm.
And from that, the trainers then set the training program leading up to the World Cup so that those players were training specifically for the exact physiological demands that were going to be required, rather than what the demands were going to be on the basis of what everybody assumed to be correct.
I see.
It wasn't correct.
Okay.
You know, what I was able to do basically was to show the All Blacks organization exactly where the errors were in their assumptions about the physiological demands of playing rugby union at the highest level, so that they could then train in such a way as not to waste so much energy and time in a way that was not going to help.
Wow, that's awesome. Okay.
So that's the kind of thing I've done before in terms of those kind of consultancies. I mean, along those lines as well, I did the same sort of thing with several military organizations. To name them specifically, the Royal Australian and Royal New Zealand Defence Forces, basically.
Okay, very cool. So I have the rare opportunity to talk to someone on this podcast who doesn't have a background in Agile, because most people that I talk to do. So, and I'm going to ask you, what is Scrum in rugby?
Okay, so
Scrum?
Scrum is a restart of play down for some reason. It's like scrimmage in gridiron, American football, except it's a slightly different thing. What happens is there are two different forms of rugby. We're talking about rugby union here. So what you get is 3, 6, 7, 8, 9. The nine biggest guys, the nine forwards from each team come together and they form a kind of bird's nest, I guess. They interlock arms and the heads go in between and they come together, and it's a push shove over the ball, who's going to win the ball sort of situation. It's also an opportunity for cheap shots, punches in the face, having your guts pulled up around your neck, a quick knee up into someone's face, because it's generally out of the sight line of the referee sort of thing.
Okay.
An opportunity to sort each other out and, you know, talk about various people's sister and auntie and whatever else. And but mainly it's a restart, so it's a push and shove to see, you know, which side is the bigger, stronger, who's going to win the ball.
So not much different than software development Scrum. Just kidding. Actually, yeah. All right. So basically, the background is that Scrum is a framework, a process framework for developing solving complex adaptive problems, which software development would fall into that. And you could use it for other things, but it was created for software development. And it, not getting in too much into the weeds, but basically it prescribes certain ceremonies and events which have to happen in a cadence. And it also prescribes that the teams are cross-functional, which means that you have all the skill sets on the team to take an idea, to take a hypothesis and go test it out, to deliver on that. And so you don't need like external teams to do it. And also that the team is self-organizing, meaning that decision-making is decentralized to the team. So there's these concepts of Scrum that are fundamentals in order for it to work properly. And I would say quite often, a lot of these fundamentals are bastardized. So there's that. But one of the most bastardized ones, aside from self-organization and cross-functionality, I would say, is that Scrum is meant to be based on an empirical process. And so Scrum has this concept, the way they describe empiricism in the Scrum Guide, is that Scrum has three pillars: inspection, adaption, and transparency. So what that means is, in a software development context, is that you can't inspect and adapt on anything if it's not transparent. So everything you do must be transparent. Anybody walking around where the developers are working should be able to see real quick what the progress is, what they're working on, you know, maybe who can use the actual product. We're supposed to have working software, not just like building little pieces of things. Also, there's these events. So there's one event called a sprint review, which is basically an opportunity for end users, customers, stakeholders to review working products and give feedback on it with the intent of improving the products, right? So it's like you can have all these ideas in your head and you think you know what you want, but until you see it and use it in your hand, then you say, oh, I didn't know. Now I see it. I think they should do this, or I think we should change it, right? So that's the transparency, the inspection and adaption. And the other part is obviously focusing on delivering software that works so we can get it in customers' hands to learn. Right. So that is what it's meant to be. It's meant to be this empirical process, and it's meant to welcome change, which is very contrary to the way traditional software development is done, is where change is looked at as a bad thing. What they tend to do in traditional software development is lock a scope down. That's what it is. So it's cost, time, and scope. And they'll say, hey, we want to deliver this much software by this time for this cost. Go do it. And do you think you can do it?
Hey, Mike. Glad you could join me for some great seafood.
Me too.
Wait, why are you dressed in fishing gear?
You said we were going out to catch great seafood, right?
Yes, to Popeyes. Do you even know how to fish?
No, I thought you did.
Oh, yeah. I could catch pretty good seafood at Popeyes. Let's go.
Let Popeyes do the fishing while you enjoy our delicious signature seafood. Get Popeyes flounder fish sandwich or shrimp tackle box before they're gone. Limited time at participating U.S. restaurants.
And then usually people are pressured into saying yes. And these things are very complex adaptive problems. And because of that, it ends up with generally poor results. That's why people want to move to a more empirical process. But as you probably know, human change is not easy. And people kind of take this new process, new way of working, and they just kind of cram in their old ways of working, and it becomes bastardized, right? Mm-hmm. So Scrum has become a way of building increments of work, but not really using an empirical process, meaning it's kind of still looked at as, and not in all companies, of course, but a lot of companies that I would say bastardize it, what they do is they say, hey, here's a bunch of stuff we're going to go build. We got the funding for it. Just go build it in 2-week chunks instead of year-long chunks. But really, we're not going to use an empirical process. We're not going to learn. And we're going to still do these big bang releases. We're not going to put things into production really quick to test out. We're not going to use hypothesis-driven development. So my point is that it is really the missing key to the missing piece, really, in Scrum and also in Agile, because you know, one of the Agile values is that we value the ability to respond to change over following a plan. And you can't really respond to change without getting things in end users' hands and without learning and using data to be able to make the right decisions to respond to the change. So really, the empirical process is really the kind of the missing piece in a lot of Agile transformations. That's what I would say. Mm-hmm. So I know this may sound a little weird to you if you're not used to it, but that's okay. I have to really just kind of put it in context for the listeners who are used to us talking about that.
It absolutely does. And there are parallels absolutely in academia. What we find very often is that you will hear a statement made by academics, and generally what it is, it's along the lines of scientific knowledge advances one funeral at a time. In other words, the old professor has built their career on a given model. This is how things are done. These are the underlying assumptions. This is what the old professor believed to be correct.
Mm-hmm.
Anybody who challenged that would be tied, frankly. And how very dare you, actually? Do you know how important I am and stuff?
Right.
And they will continue to espouse that idea because they've built their career on it, whether it's correct or not, whether it's been empirically tested or not. They will throw up a smoke and mirrors empirical test for that, for a lot of stuff.
I see.
And fix it with, you know, do you know who I am, and you know, how dare you, sort of thing. And they will continue to espouse that idea, and they will continue to teach that idea until basically they retire, or more frequently, they drop dead.
So that would be like Ansel Keys and Friends, I'm guessing.
As an example.
All right.
Ansel Keys, that's a great example.
Yeah. All right.
Basically, what we're saying here is that we have in academia, what actually prevails, what overrides, is a pseudo-scientific farce, a smoke and mirrors approach to empiricism that fools not only the public, but also most of the people in academia who don't actually have the wherewithal or background to challenge ideas and to think about things, rather they are people who are, I'm not going to say weak-minded, but they're the sort of people who are easily molded. They're the sort of people who will be attracted by a research grant paid for by a company that has brought the results of the research before it even begins. As you say, completely bastardizing the process of empirical hypothesis testing. So what it becomes when you fund research, when industry funds research, as it does, of course, it becomes an exercise for the academic in supporting a hypothesis. Remember at the start, what we said was actually, if you're a scientist, if you're following the scientific discipline, your responsibility is to prove your hypothesis wrong, not right.
Right.
Because, you know, it's easy to present an argument that something is right, even if it isn't. That's easily done. That's right. A smoke and mirrors exercise. But if you have empirical data, which comes from a design which is designed in such a way as to be capable of absolutely refuting without question, that's actual empiricism. That's the actual test. For example, Pim and I say there will be dangerous oxidation products in 8 out of 12 samples. And we test 12 samples with a machine that's capable of testing these products at minuscule concentrations, much more than, you know, any form of chemistry. And the machine turns around and says, nope, it's not there. That is an absolute open and shut case, isn't it? We have disproved our hypothesis. Our methodology was capable of proving us wrong.
Yeah.
As it was, unfortunately, we were not wrong. There it is, without any question. The machine says, I have detected aldehydes, dangerous oxidation products. There they are.
Right. So piggybacking on that, that's one of the things, you know, as a coach, that when I work with the product folks, I try to get them thinking about things that, hey, you know, you have these people in product management and product development. They're very skilled, they're very intelligent, they have a lot of experience, but like anything, we all have our cognitive biases, right? So everybody does. It's really unavoidable. So, and this leads me into my next question, but this is something I'm just giving you some experience here, is that one of the ways that I try to coach this kind of more hypothesis-driven empirical development is come up with the leading indicators in such a way that will smash through your cognitive bias. Meaning, if you think that, you know, that users really want this thing, you could probably easily design a set of metrics to prove your hypothesis right, because that's a natural behavior, because you have a cognitive bias around this thing. So really design your metrics with ranges in such a way where your cognitive bias could be wrong. And if it's wrong, that's what we want to know. We want to know that as soon as possible, because the longer we delay finding out if we're wrong about our cognitive biases, the more harm we're doing to the company, because it's costing more money, it's costing more time, and our competitors are out there maybe doing the same thing, but even better. So that's why it's such key. And one more thing I'm going to say is that the catalyst to be able to really to excel or expedite an empirical process is something we call lean. So lean comes from lean manufacturing, and it's basically a way of removing bottlenecks. And this is a little more on the process side of software development and manufacturing, but really lean, thinking about our cycle time and our throughput and how fast we could deliver something to the market, instead of focusing on how much stuff we can get done. So it's like, it's basically switching the mindset of, I don't care how much I can get stuff I can get done, because I could be building the wrong thing, right? I care about how fast can I go test my hypothesis, and the foundation of that is lean. So if that's coming to some more of the agile stuff. So I wanted to ask you, in the scientific world, how do you deal with cognitive bias in an empirical environment?
You have to have a certain kind of strength to try and swim against the flow, the current.
Right.
I was always one of those who was working against the flow, because the flow in academia, to its eternal detriment, is in the promulgation and perpetuation of ideas based on anything other than the very thing science is supposed to be about, which is empirical evidences, or inferences is a better word, actually. There are all sorts of ideas predominating in the sciences that, when you actually go and follow the rabbit hole and you say, okay, this is a generally accepted idea, blah, 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 brackets, number of reference, full stop, next sentence, oh, right, okay, well, that's accepted as fact then. You go and find reference number whatever on the reference list, and you bring it up, and you read the thing, which nobody does. That's the problem. That's the difference between me as a scientist, an empiricist, and the dogmatists who are happy to accept a one-sentence statement of the nature of objective reality with a single or group, small group of references in a set of brackets, end of discussion. Again, those brackets do not denote canon. They do not denote the word of God. They denote, here are some things that have got past an editor and two peer reviewers, who could be anybody. So that's the difference. I'm the guy who will go and pull those references up and read the things from start to finish, and look at what references they've cited and go and get those and follow the rabbit hole all the way back to the very original work, which is supposed to underpin this massive torrent. You know, you'll often hear pseudoscientists say, there is voluminous research to support this idea. And then actually you go and follow it through, as I do, and you find that there is no such thing.
Right.
There's an original person who's made a statement, and it's like Chinese whispers, if you like to think of it that way. The difference between the pseudoscientist, the dogmatist, and the empiricist, the actual genuine scientist, the scientist will go and check every single assertion for veracity and correctness, and will not accept somebody else's word. They will go and look at that data themselves. They will go and they will often actually get the original data and redo the analysis. You know, when I was teaching statistics, for example, I was one of the most, shall we say, unloved teachers of statistics in my department. Reason being that I would not allow students to submit work to me on statistical analyses of any kind if that had been produced by some software package. For example, SPSS or Q or any of these programs that do statistics. You put the numbers in and it says, here's the result. Not acceptable. If you can't do this math longhand on a piece of paper with a calculator, if you can't do an Excel spreadsheet and show me step by step that you have done this repeated measures and over analysis for me, you fail. Because you have no idea what you're talking about. So, you know, anybody can be trained to use a software package. That's how software is designed. Correct me if I'm wrong on this. That's supposed to be user-friendly.
Yes.
Netflix is not user-friendly.
Right.
You have to understand what you're doing to get anything like a valid result. So, I guess if the question is what's the difference between the empiricist and not, I guess for me, that's it. It's the one who will actually do the analysis, the one who will question every statement of fact that's made.
So one of the ways that we try to deal with that in the agile space and the product development world is that even though one person may write the hypothesis potentially, and the leading indicators, one of the things we try to do is get people to, multiple people to work on this hypothesis and leading indicators. So one person may initiate it, but it is kind of peer reviewed. That's the concept, right? Before anybody goes and spends any money or time working on it. So you have already had multiple minds working on it. So we have this event where it's really just a meeting called a feature refinement, in which multiple people will come together and product. This is in a scaling environment, and review and refine these bigger initiatives and put, you know, I'll look at the leading indicators, look at the hypothesis, ask the questions. So you try to remove one person's cognitive bias, because they could write those leading indicators one way to try to prove themselves right, right? And they might not be doing it for some malice. It might just be because they have a cognitive bias and they don't even realize it, right? And the second part is that when you are testing that hypothesis with actual end users, that you don't just have one person in a vacuum looking at this data, looking at the results, is that you also work in a group and a collaborative method and say, hey, we want to make the data transparent when it comes in, so not just only one person can see it, we can have a discussion about it. And so this leads me to my next kind of, and maybe final topic, is how to implement this in an agile world. And one of them is to use this hypothesis-driven development at any level. You can use it for the folks in the agile space, they'll be familiar with these terms. You can use it at the epic level, the feature level, or even at the story level. Although usually you would probably use it more at the feature and epic level, if your stories are small enough. And then you can also use it, you know, there's a group that we put together in some environments called a lean portfolio management. And this is a group of people who are looking at a portfolio of products and constantly thinking about how to remove waste and how to test hypothesis on a bunch of big ideas across the whole organization. And so when the results, or when the data is starting to roll in for testing these hypotheses, this group, which is a cross-functional group, but like at the more at the top level of the company, can also look at the data, not just one person, a product manager. So there's a lot of ways to get started with this. And then I would say, if you're just working on one team, if you just have one Scrum team, for example, at a company, and you're either a new startup or you're working at a big company, just have one team, use the empirical process at the team level. Inspect and adapt. Don't be what we call a feature factory, which is basically just somebody just pays for a bunch of ideas and you go build it, and you don't have any input or say into the process, into the product itself, into the empiricism, that you use this empirical method of inspection, adaption, hypothesis testing, welcoming change, these types of things, because this is what the mindset is supposed to be about, and this is what the process is supposed to be about. So that's and if you're interested in these things, a couple of resources you can look at. One is the Scrum Guide itself. Two is the Agile Manifesto. Three is there's something called Lean Software Development, which is a book by Mary and Tom Popenick, which gets into some of this stuff. There's another book called Lean Startup. There's another book called Lean UX. So I'll link these in the show description, and this can kind of get you started on some of these, this way of thinking, if you're not used to it.
Cool. I just have one final little bit of advice, I guess, in terms of hypothesis generation.
Okay.
And that is, when folk are putting together hypotheses, whatever they may be, just double check yourself and perhaps check with your peers, etc. Have everybody read it and check it for. A hypothesis needs to be empirical in nature. In other words, you need to apply a metric to the result. So words like best, or, you know, effective, shouldn't be in a hypothesis. The hypothesis should be a statement of numerical relationship between variables or categoricals. Having done that, and make sure that your hypothesis is about either a category, yes or no, or about a metric, numbers zero, whatever, then check that your testing methodology for that hypothesis is capable of absolutely refuting that hypothesis, yes or no.
Right.
Once you've got those two things in play and you're doing those two things, it's my genuine opinion that the productivity will vastly increase just on the basis of those two very, very minor things. So there you go. Advice for free from a scientist.
All right, Bart. So let me ask you this. Where can people, and I actually would like to preface this next part. For the folks who may be easily offended by some off-color language, right? Mm. If you go to Bart's YouTube channel.
Yeah, probably shouldn't go there to my channel for that.
Yeah. Okay. So Bart has a YouTube channel, which I said is about half entertainment, half education. And even in the entertainment part, he does try to educate, but he uses his own personality. And sometimes it can be very funny, but it's a bit like the Agile Uprising where we're a little bit of rubber rouser. So that's, I think you kind of fall in line with that. I would highly encourage if you're into that, you know, please go there and check out his YouTube channel. If you're really into the science behind what Bart is talking about in the empirical method and, you know, his YouTube channel is one place, but I would really encourage you to check out his Patreon. Really, it is a wealth of knowledge for a small amount of money. I think it's like the base level is $10 a month or something. So $10 a month and you get access to, I'm guessing, a lot of the videos and then you have like another tier, which is like a private consultations and all that thing. So I would really encourage the folks out there who, if you're interested in anything Bart's talking about, empirical process and exercise physiology and nutrition, empirical science behind these things, you know, this is what Bart mainly focuses on in his Patreon. So I'd like to promote that. Is there anything else you'd like to promote? I know you've developed a class as well, right?
Yeah, Pim, my lovely partner, and I have put together a 6-month course. Well, actually it's two courses that run parallel. One is for people who suffer from anxiety disorder, depressive disorders, mental health issues. And we look at that from the standpoint of the nutrition and the physiology involved, actually. Mm. Okay. Neither one of us is a counselor per se. That's not what the course is about. It's about actually dealing with the underpinning physiological reasons for the anxiety, mental health disorders, etc. Basically, they are around inflammation of the brain tissue. They are around imbalances in chemical balances in the brain and things like that. We are both kind of, that's where we come from. We're both empirical scientists, Pim and I. You know, she has a master's degree in nutrition. You know, I have, or she also has another undergrad. She has a bachelor's degree also in biomedical science as well. Mm-hmm. You know, I've got 3 advanced degrees in physiology, variously, exercise physiology, and indeed cardiovascular pathophysiology and all that kind of stuff. So that's kind of the level of where we're at. We both have peer-reviewed publications in the literature and that kind of stuff. So it's not counselling for mental health. It's how to actually fix it using,
I see,
mainly dietary intervention, because diet is the biggest problem. And then we have another course which runs parallel, which is about people who have autoimmune dysfunction. In other words, they have things like skin conditions, they have allergic conditions, they have arthritic conditions, they have fibromyalgia, those kind of things. And again, we use the dietary and lifestyle intervention to help with that. And it's a full immersion 6-month long course where you get X number of videos per week, depending on the week number and what the topic is. You get live Q&A sessions with Pim and myself, which are additional and separate to our live online entertainment YouTube channel things that we do weekly. Mm-hmm. And also there's a graduated membership where you can be like a self a self-starter, if you like, or a self-study person who gets all of that, or you can be a VIP member who gets a lot of one-on-one time with both Pim and myself as well, face-to-face. And you can find all that information on our website, which is www.reinstallyourhealth, all one word, all lowercase, .com.
All right.
So go and check that out. I'm sure Troy will link that underneath as well, in the editing process. So that's pretty much that. I will also sort of parrot, I guess, and reflect what Troy is saying there. Look, my YouTube channel is designed for a certain audience. It's designed for a certain outcome, and that is advertising revenue. Therefore, the material on the site is largely about what gets clicks. And I'll tell you what gets clicks. It's short words. It's angst. It's conflict with others on YouTube. As Troy says, there is a lot of science there. I actually give away a lot of knowledge and a lot of science for free there on my YouTube channel. But you also have to be prepared that, it's pretty lowbrow stuff. A lot of the time it's short words, and it's saying why others have got it wrong using the shortest possible terminologies. So that's it. And then as he says, if you want the actual science and the sort of professional analysis and stuff, then absolutely the Patreon/subscribestar offerings are where it's at. $10 a month gets you access to one or more videos on a monthly basis, where I will look into an issue in much more depth and not say so many short words.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Probably not any at all, I don't think. Maybe the other one slips in, but it's not supposed to. The delineation. So that's what I do. Very much.
Very cool. Well, thank you, Bart. I really appreciate your time. Coming from a scientific perspective, bringing that into the Agile space, because I think it's sorely needed. Mm. And I really enjoyed having you on. I hope everyone checks out his Patreon, Subscribestar, and the class and everything else. And thanks again.
If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.